coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. A group of Delmarva power workers have returned to the First State after a stint helping restore power to areas of Puerto Rico still recovering from Hurricane Maria.
I felt like I was part of a small army, and I feel good at what we did as a whole. I'm not really satisfied, but I'm just saying what we did over there, we did well.
Our Katie Pike spoke with one of those workers about their efforts and experiences in Puerto Rico. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We'll also hear about what Delaware Shakespeare has in store for its 2018 season in our latest arts playlist. Plus, we bring you a new episode of the UD Center for Political Communications Midterm Matters podcast. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the latest news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Puerto Rico has been struggling to fully restore power since Hurricane Maria hit in September, and even this week suffered a major island-wide power outage. Over the past 3 months, Pepco Holdings sent employees from its regional utility companies, including two crews of 25 from Delmarva Power, to the island to assist with power restoration efforts. The second crew returned from Puerto Rico earlier this month, and Delaware Public Media's Katie Pike spoke to one of them, Delmarva Power journeyman line mechanic Chad Rodriguez, this week about his experience there.
So, Chad, you arrived in Puerto Rico in February, and you and the crew headed to the Caguas region outside of San Juan. Paint a picture for me. What did you see?
It's one of the most remote parts of the island, just mountains and tall hills. And once we got to the areas we were going to be working at, we saw just debris everywhere, wires, poles down, houses with roofs ripped off, people walking around tired and, you know, waiting for their electricity, doing what they had to do every day without electricity. But it was a mess. The poles were old. They snapped off on the ground, in the neighborhoods, behind the houses, down cliffs. Just a mess.
So take me kind of from beginning to end. What did the crews from Delmarva Power and Pepco Holdings, what did you guys do to help restore power?
From beginning to end, well, in the beginning, the material was slow coming in. So first week was basically just trying to scramble for what was out there, sometimes reusing what was on the ground just to get started. Then the material started coming in on the barges. So then it was rocking and rolling. We had what we needed, just setting poles, erecting new poles, and putting wire up, primary wire up, and then going through the neighborhoods and putting their service wires up. That's basically what we were doing the whole time. And it's just a remote region. Every day was about a two-hour drive up the mountain. And, you know, just driving poles up that way on some narrow two-way roads where you look over the side and there's about a 200-300-foot drop. So you see the rest of the island. The driving was a big challenge. It was hard work, and our guys, we really worked hard to get it done. It's just an everyday challenge, just pushing through, getting people back in power.
What were some of the challenges that you faced?
The terrain was the biggest challenge, and clearing out the wire that was on the ground and getting set up to put new poles up and putting new wire up. Those were the main challenges, just making room to work. In the neighborhood, some of the people had areas cleaned out for us because they were just months with a mess on the roads and behind the yards. The terrain was a big problem. The truck sitting not level and flying a boom, that was kind of, you know, hairy, doing the work with the truck sitting at angles. But we did it the safest way we could do it. Every day was a challenge, but you just had to push and just keep pushing and getting the job done.
Chad, that picture that you painted for me, debris everywhere, old poles, as you were leaving the island, how did that picture change?
The crew I was with, I know for sure, 10, 11 guys, we did the town of Ay Bonito. and we got about 600, close to 700 people in power. There were some areas that we were not able to get because we were kind of pushing along where it was quickest to get the power back on. So as we were leaving, it was the relief crews were going to come and get those customers that we might have missed or just to decided to keep moving because it was best to stay on the path we were at the time. So leaving was kind of, I didn't want to leave, put it that way. I mean, there was still work to do, and there's still a lot of work on that island, a lot of investing in the infrastructure itself, new poles. They need miles of wire. There's years of work to strengthen that infrastructure. Leaving was definitely hard to do, and I'm ready to go back right now.
The Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority actually sent a request for help, and Edison Electrical Institute coordinated this restoration effort with more than 1,500 people across the board. So that number really speaks to itself, but did you feel like you were a part of something big?
Definitely. We went down full force. My company had, I believe, 150-plus workers there. We had 77 trucks. We had a barge full of equipment go down. I felt like I was part of a small army, and I feel good of what we did as a whole. Well, I'm not really satisfied, but I'm just saying what we did over there, we did well, each and every one of our guys down there. Still a lot of work to do, but what we did, what we went to do, we did it, and I felt good about it.
After you and your crew and then the second wave of Pepco Holdings employees left the island, 96% of power was restored.
Correct.
And then a total blackout earlier this week.
There was one last week also. They said a tree hit a transmission line. That's not what we were working on. Transmission brings power across the island, north, south, east, and west. So that's a major line that they put out. And then this week, it's supposedly a backhoe working at the base of a tower hit the tower. Those are transmission lines, so that's why you can knock a whole island out or whatever. And hopefully everything can stay up consistently. I mean, we got the storm season coming, and it doesn't look good. The projections don't look good. So there's a lot of work on that island, and it's going to be years of work.
So the blackout that happened and the other one that you just talked about had nothing to do with the work that you and the crews were doing?
No, we were working in towns and in distribution. That transmission is the number one feed that gets it to distribution. So we were like working on the end user side.
Since there were so many crews, you know, helping Puerto Rico restore power, does it surprise you at all that something like this happened after all of the work that was put in?
I'm going to say that without the weather, yeah, that does surprise me, you know. But when the weather comes, when the hurricane season comes, there's going to be more. I mean, you can't solidify that island with just 6 months of work. They're so outdated that down there they need investment down there that's going to last, you know, through time. You know, we went down there, it was a humanitarian after people out for 6 months. So we had, you know, get things back up in the air and heat it up so they can get their basic power. So when you talk about backing that up with money, more new poles and updated technology and stuff like that, that's years you're talking. You're not talking the next storm season is coming. So, I mean, yes, the tower coming down without a storm and stuff, it seems like it was a mistake. Somebody hit it. That surprises me. But things do happen. There's a lot of construction going on and heavy equipment being moved.
Thanks to Delmarva Power journeyman line mechanic Chad Rodriguez and our Katie Pikus for their time on The Green this week. You can hear more from this interview online at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And stay with us. The Green continues with a look at what Delaware Shakespeare has on its playbill this year. That's in our arts playlist. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Delaware Shakespeare's 2018 season kicks off in June with a weekend of scenes at Longwood Gardens in Kennett Square, PA. It will also have Much Ado About Nothing at its summer festival at Rockwood Park in July and performances of The Merchant of Venice in its 2018 community tour. But the Longwood Gardens Summer Performance Series is the newest addition to this quickly growing slate of Shakespearean entertainment being performed around the state. And in this week's arts playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele speaks with David Stradley, the producing artistic director of Delaware Shakespeare.
All right, a lot happening, David. Delaware Shakespeare's 2018 season will be featuring a weekend of scenes at Longwood, plus Much Ado About Nothing and The Merchant of Venice. Let's talk about the Longwood Gardens event first.
Yeah, that's going to be really exciting. We were very flattered that about a year ago, Longwood Gardens approached us and asked us to put together some proposals for Shakespeare programming there at the Gardens. And what we came up with for this first partnership is kind of a Shakespeare takeover of the Gardens. We will perform five different iconic Shakespeare scenes at five different iconic Longwood Gardens locations. So we'll do things like the balcony scene from Romeo and Juliet atop the walkway of the main fountain gardens, and a great fight scene from Midsummer Night's Dream in front of the entrance to the meadow, and the funeral orations from Julius Caesar and the Italian Water Garden. So, I mean, Longwood is such a beautiful location. We could have easily have done 30 scenes in 30 locations, but we thought we'd limit it to just five and focus on some of the best of the best.
I was going to say, I'm a member of Longwood, and it's just beautiful up there. What, you couldn't ask for a more perfect setting for something like this.
Yeah. Well, I will stick up for our longtime home of Rockwood Garden, Rockwood Park, and say that's a lovely setting as well for outdoor Shakespeare.
It is.
But yeah, Longwood, it was just very fun to walk the grounds with their performing arts staff and say, ooh, we could do something here, we could do something there. It'll be fun for, Longwood Garden members and Del Shakes fans as well to come and just kind of rove around the grounds and follow us over the course of the day. It'll be structured so that you can see all five scenes kind of within a two-hour cycle, and we'll repeat each scenes two or three times during the course of each day.
Has anything like this been done at Longwood before?
Not to my knowledge. They of course have a tremendous repertoire of different events there, but as far as we've been talking to the performing arts staff, this is the first time they think there's been kind of Shakespeare done in this roving manner.
All right, so when is Shakespeare coming to Longwood?
We will be there Saturday and Sunday, June 16th and 17th. And it is the Shakespeare events are free with your regular admission to the garden, so you don't have to buy a special ticket for the event. You just come to the gardens. If you're a member, you can get in free, or you can, buy a ticket for the day and enjoy the gardens and see Shakespeare while you're there.
All right, let's move on to the summer festival stage at Rockwood Park. What's happening there?
So this is our 16th year and our 13th at Rockwood Park, and we're very excited to be doing Shakespeare's great Battle of the Sexes, Much Ado About Nothing. It's a joyous play. We did it 13 years ago. It was actually the first play we did when we moved to Rockwood back in 2007. So we're excited to kind of revisit and do it even with even more joy and panache.
All right, and then we've got the community tour as well. What's that all about?
So our community tour, it was our newest program that we started 3 years ago, and the goal for that is to really take Shakespeare to the full spectrum of humanity in our state by traveling to non-traditional locations such as prisons and homeless shelters, psychiatric hospitals, community centers, libraries. This year we're going to do The Merchant of Venice, which is one of Shakespeare's kind of most complicated and multi-layered plays. It's a play that deals with xenophobia in general, and specifically anti-Semitism. And in this time when we've seen a rise of hate speech and hate activity, it seems like, unfortunately, a timely moment to re-examine this play. So we've been in deep and respectful conversations with Jewish community and faith groups over the last 6 months to figure out kind of how the best way to approach this play. And we're really interested to do this as a conversation with our community about how we can ensure that those who are looked at as different are not treated unjustly. So we'll be doing 3 weeks of these performances in different locations, and every performance will be followed with a conversation with the audience about a discussion about what they saw in the play, how it connects to our lives today, and how we as a community can take steps to try to make our community a better place.
And to top it all off, Delaware Shakespeare is coming to Rehoboth Beach to the Bandstand.
Yeah, that's going to be a lot of fun. You know, 2 years ago was the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's death, and we kind of created this event that year thinking it would be a one-time thing where we'd gather community members to sprint through lines from all of Shakespeare's 38 plays in an hour, and we did it up in Wilmington that first year thinking it was going to be a one-off, and it was so much fun that we decided to start roving it through the state. So last year we were on the Green in Dover, and this year the city of Rehoboth Beach said, hey, why don't you do it at the Bandstand? So we're working hard right now to gather members of the Rehoboth Beach community, business leaders, arts leaders, education leaders, faith leaders, to come and strut their stuff on the Bandstand with 15 or 20 seconds of great Shakespeare.
All right, you are the producing artistic director of Delaware Shakespeare, yeah. So I'm going to put you on the spot. Favorite venue for these types of events? What is your favorite venue? Come on, I'm going to put you on the spot.
That's impossible to do because the great thing that we found is that each venue brings something special and magical. But I will say, if you put me on the spot, I will say that my favorite place we have done Shakespeare in the last 2 years has been Baylor Women's Correctional Institution.
Wow, really?
We have done our community tour there the first 2 years. And the audiences have been amazing and have appreciated the plays and have gotten into them. We did acting classes there last year as well. And you could not have asked for a more responsive and enthusiastic audience for Shakespeare that we've had at Baylor Women's Correctional Institution in the last 2 years.
That was Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele and David Stradley, the producing artistic director of Delaware Shakespeare, joining us for this week's Arts Playlist. You can find more information about all of Delaware Shakespeare's shows at delshakes.org. And stay with us. The Green continues with the latest edition of the University of Delaware Center for Political Communications podcast, Midterm Matters. That's after a look at your local news headlines from Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green. I'm Tom Byrne. This week we bring you another edition of the Midterm Matters podcast from the University of Delaware Center for Political Communication. The podcast is part of the Center for Political Communication's upcoming national agenda series, Midterm Matters, addressing the importance of voter and civic engagement in midterm elections, as well as campaign strategy, news coverage, polling, and more. On this episode, I was joined by UD Center for Political Communication Associate Director and National Agenda Series Director, Dr. Lindsay Hoffman, who teaches communication and political science at UD. We are also joined by Dr. Dana Young, UD Associate Professor of Communication, who studies politics and communications, including political media effects, public opinion, political satire, and the psychology of political humor. Hope you enjoy this conversation with them on the newest edition of the Midterm Matters podcast.
Well, let's start off by talking about who should or shouldn't be talking about politics, or at least the public's perception of that. The Center for Political Communication recently released a national poll looking at what people think about athletes and other celebrities weighing in on politics. Came just weeks after conservative Fox News host Laura Ingraham criticized LeBron James, of all people, for talking politics, telling him to shut up and dribble. The poll found more than 40% of Republicans say it is not at all appropriate for professional athletes to speak out on political issues or causes, compared to approximately 5% of Democrats. Meanwhile, nearly 60% of Democrats say such speech is very appropriate, with just over 8% of Republicans saying so. Independents much more evenly distributed. I don't know that these numbers surprised me, especially when you focus on athletes in particular. What did you think? Was this surprising? I guess maybe the only thing that surprised me might have been the gap between the two sides. Dana?
I was going to say that obviously, so we set out to examine this because we anticipated exactly what we found, so it wasn't surprising in that regard. I think the size of the gap was a lot larger than we would have anticipated. What's interesting is that the gap extends across all the categories of celebrities that we looked at, right? So the idea of celebrity actors and athletes. What's fascinating to me is that this I recognize that it might seem super intuitive because a lot of these are individuals who are speaking out on the political left. So, of course, Republicans would be less likely to embrace these people speaking out. But I would venture to guess that there's something else going on here, too, that it's not just that these celebrities are on the left, but that, you know, some of my work suggests that conservatives might be less comfortable with what I consider hybrid forms of political information, so people who are simultaneously based in entertainment and information. I think the notion of these people that are in occupy both lanes, I think might be something that's less comfortable for conservatives, and they really want their people to pick a lane. Either you're here for entertainment or you are here as a political personality. You need to pick one. Something that I think was on display at the promo for the American Country Music Awards, where Reba McEntire ends the promo by saying, "The only statement we're making is fun." And I thought that was quite, that sort of, to me, that was the embodiment of stay in your lane.
Yeah, well, and I think the activism that we've seen among athletes and celebrities has tended to lean more liberal. So I think that when we ask Republicans that kind of question, that's who they're going to think of. They're going to think of Colin Kaepernick. They're going to think of Black Lives Matter. What I kind of wish we'd done in retrospect when we did this poll was ask specifically about certain types of celebrities, because we've seen this Roseanne phenomenon since this poll came out. And although Roseanne's viewings have gotten less, and I think it's in its week three, it still had the most viewers on of any program on any network for Tuesday night. So I think in some cases, conservatives, had we asked the question specifically about Roseanne or specifically about maybe other celebrities who have come out in support of the president, they might have a different position. So up for the next poll, I guess.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, just for people who may not have seen the poll, just to give them a sense of what's there, there was another question that kind of broadened things out to when celebrities speak about politics, they are exercising their First Amendment rights, agree or disagree. Among Democrats, the number there, 57% strongly agreed, 30% agreed. Among Republicans, nearly 18% strongly agreed, 51% agreed with the same statement. And again, not sure that I was surprised by that gap either. And just kind of talking about, you know, there is kind of a historical perspective here. You're going all the way back, let's say, to like the Dixie Chicks, who made a comment about President Bush during his administration.
And I can't believe that the Dixie Chicks is a historical precedent, by the way. I thought you were going to go way back.
Sadly, yeah, it is. I mean, but their career was kind of derailed at that point by making that kind of comment and the reaction it got. And certainly, I think at the time...
But they weren't ready to make nice.
They were not ready to make nice. And you can sing that if you'd like to.
Is that going to be the thing now on this podcast?
Exactly. Lindsay sings. That'll be the next segment on the podcast. For those who missed the first one, Lindsay wanted to try to get us all to sing We Are the World. We wouldn't do it with her.
Come on.
But maybe, yeah, not ready to make nice. Maybe we could do that one. But it did kind of derail their career. And at the time, I think a lot of people looked at it and thought, well, it's because they're in the country music genre. And so their audience specifically was not going to take to criticizing a Republican president. But it seems that maybe there is a little bit, it goes a little bit deeper than just that, or at least it has developed into something that goes a little bit deeper than that.
Well, what I think is fascinating about this particular question, because we not just asked about whether it's appropriate for celebrities to speak out, but we asked, do you believe that this is a matter of exercising First Amendment rights? And when I look at this graph, which you can find on cpc.udel.edu, is Democrats strongly agree with this statement. Far fewer Republicans strongly agree, but it doesn't follow the same pattern as we saw in the other questions. Because, you know, you can't really say, I don't agree with the First Amendment. That's sort of a social desirability issue. I think that even Republicans agreed with this statement. 51% of them agreed with it, because it's kind of dissonant to say I don't think celebrities should exercise their First Amendment rights.
So somehow they've lost their rights by being celebrities.
And I think that, you know, it goes along with, we've heard, you know, the Second Amendment has been in discussion a lot over the past few months, and I think there's sort of a kind of a trigger to the idea of you know, regulating First Amendment rights or Second Amendment rights.
And what's interesting is that the way that we ask this question, as opposed to something that's sort of driven by your emotional response, either you support or oppose something, this statement was, when celebrities speak out about politics, they're exercising their First Amendment rights. To what extent do you agree or disagree? So the reality is, like, based on the definition of the First Amendment, that literally is it, right? That when people, anyone, humans who are, you know, living in America, speak out about politics, that's literally what they're doing. They're exercising their First Amendment rights. So I think what's nice about having included this item is it does show that there are ways to sort of reframe issues where you can rein in some of those polarization effects by reminding people, no, actually, this is the definition of the First Amendment.
That's a good point.
But it does. It is something I find interesting only because, you know, you mentioned Colin Kaepernick. I mean, Colin Kaepernick still can't get a job in the NFL. As a matter of fact, even recently, the Seattle Seahawks had agreed to bring him in to kind of like work him out, check him out, and at the last second, and changed their mind, saying that they had, or at least the reporting was that they had asked that he, you know, guarantee that he wasn't going to do the kneeling thing again, and that kind of scrapped everything. And so here it is. I mean, he still can't kind of break through that perception and the worries that the NFL seems to have about what having him on any team might have on the league or that particular team.
Well, the other thing I think is kind of fascinating about this is when you do look at celebrities and athletes, while certainly in the realm of government and speaking about within the United States, you have First Amendment rights. But as an employee of a non-governmental organization, your speech can certainly be regulated. So there are going to be effects like that. If celebrities and athletes do choose to speak out on a particular issue, they may well face that kind of backlash and have their employment affected by it.
So to wrap up this topic, I just want to ask, what do you think, if you're a politician running in this midterm election cycle, you should be taking from numbers like this in terms of whether you want to associate with celebrities, whether you want to have celebrities stump for you or bring, you know, musicians with very strongly held political beliefs in to play at your rally or something like that. Is there a message for politicians in these numbers?
I tend to see this as a chicken and egg question because, I'm sort of knee-deep in this political psychology literature right now, and I think that it is just a more natural inclination for liberal candidates mm-hmm. to consider those avenues in the first place. And so I think that there's just, the whole thing is lopsided because these celebrities tend to be on the left, they tend to be Democrats, and Democrats tend to then increasingly have them to perform at their rallies. And the idea of right now we have, actually on both sides, we have celebrities who themselves are running for office, mm-hmm. right? So you have Cynthia Nixon and things. So it's cloudy.
Do you ever feel though that the Republicans do sometimes try to force it a little bit, like, well, we've got, you know, Ted Nugent, we've got, you know, they try to find someone who can be their person in that realm.
I think what this suggests is that, you know, Democrats would do well to engage celebrities and athletes in their cause in the midterms. I think what it suggests is that the Republicans might do well if they do wish to engage those types of celebrities. Those celebrities should be saying, celebrities shouldn't have a say on politics. And that is kind of the MO. I think that would work. If that's how, if you're a Republican and that's how you want to use a celebrity, that's probably going to be the most effective way to do it.
I do think, though, that on the other hand, it is, if Democrats are looking to reach across the aisle and they really do want to show that they're operating in the spirit of bipartisanship and trying to narrow this huge gap that exists between us, I do not think that having yet another celebrity, Hollywood, whatever, stumping with you is going to really convey that message for you.
All right, let's move on to some other big stories that have been out there in the ether. House Speaker Paul Ryan says he is not going to run again. Before we talk about what that means writ large for Republicans, any thoughts kind of just generally on his legacy, for lack of a better term, in Congress and as Speaker? He was at one point kind of, you know, a rising GOP star, and so he, you know, took the Speaker's job, you know, somewhat reluctantly with the hope that maybe he could kind of bring things together. Is there a sense of who is Paul Ryan as he walks away from that stage?
I actually, this might surprise folks, I feel quite bad for Paul Ryan.
I do too.
I feel like what happened with Trump, I think that it is an impossible situation that he has been in. And I think that being the face of the GOP leadership really puts a target on him. And that is exactly how things have kind of rolled out. over the last year. I bet that we're going to see his political career carry on in other important ways. He is someone who has always been passionate about public service and politics. I really don't anticipate that ending.
Well, I think, people are kind of giving him a hard time for saying that this is because he wants to spend more time with his family. And, you know, people might not recall, but his father actually passed away when he was just, I think, 15 years old. He was quite young. And so I think that, you know, maybe sometimes we should take people at their word and just say, you know what, I understand. Mm-hmm. I think that that's what we've lost in some sense in the past couple of years in this, first the run-up to the election and then Trump's rhetoric in his presidency, is I think we've lost that sense of empathy and compassion for each other and seeing each other as human beings, and everyone's simply this other. So for me, I choose to look, say, you know what, I understand that. I have a family. I understand why that might be the reason you want to leave.
Or one of the reasons. And even if that isn't actually the driving factor, guess what? That is going to be something that he will be able to do then after the fact, is spend more time with his family. And you have to imagine that things have been very challenging and difficult and maybe not rewarding in the way that he had anticipated, especially over the last year. And so, it frustrates me when I hear friends on the left who are just so thrilled. And I think, this is someone who has really dedicated a lot of his life to public service, and we should never celebrate that someone, for right. whatever reason, feels that they are chased out.
But what you're saying here kind of brings me to the next question I have for you, which is, now we've got a growing list of Republicans leaving Congress. And I guess the kind of conventional wisdom is this is a purely, Trump GOP versus traditional GOP, and the traditional people are just like, I can't deal with this anymore. But is there perhaps something a little bit more here in that frustration that maybe, again, we've seen so much over recent years about, Congress is looked at with very low esteem from the public. It's a very polarized, very bipartisan. There's not a lot you can get done. Is perhaps the frustration more than just traditional GOPers frustrated trying to work within the Trump world, but there's just more people who are saying, this just isn't worth it. I can be spending more time with my family. I'm not achieving the things I would like to achieve. So why am I here again? Is that a fair way to look at it?
I think that could be part of it. I do think, though, that this particular political moment is very, very challenging for people who are traditional conservative Republicans in Congress who are trying to be true to some of the tenets of their conservative ideology in terms of their policy positions. I think this White House has posed a real conundrum for them. But at the same time, I think someone like a Paul Ryan, where you look at these party leaders and you say, is it necessarily the case that they're going to be able to better achieve goals outside of Congress? Well, maybe not, but something must be highly dysfunctional if they feel that they cannot achieve these goals in these offices that they've been elected to. It does leave me with great sadness because I increasingly feel like things are broken because some of the people who I think that have good intentions, like Jeff Flake, that to me says we need to take a long, hard look in the mirror if these lawmakers are thinking that they would be best served elsewhere.
Well, and as it is, the people who are running for office, particularly at that level with such visibility, these are people who are already motivated by popularity, by mm-hmm. who are willing to take steps that most ordinary people would not take. They would not want their married history, their family history.
The scrutiny.
Yeah, the scrutiny. And so that's what's happened in this, we talk about, it's not really politics, it's media politics is what we live in. You can't disentwine the two, if that's a word. You can't,
disentangle?
Disentangle, that works.
De-intertwine?
either way, they're inherently connected. And so the kinds of people that are running and that have been running for the past several decades are the kinds of people who in some cases value the fame more than the giving to the public good. And so I think what this suggests is this, you know, huge swath of people leaving is that we might be losing the last of those folks that are really there to do something good, and that what's left is people who are power hungry and hungry for popularity.
And part of the reason I asked the question is because, and we talked about this on the first edition of this podcast, is that there's been a lot of retirements here in Delaware as well. Now, they've been much more evenly balanced between Republicans and Democrats, but it did make me wonder if this is, this trend is kind of trickling down as well, that there are politics at the local level, or politicians, I should say, at the local level, who are saying, you know, I'm trying to do some good here. I'm trying to, you know, and it just seems like I'm just running into a wall, and it's frustrating. And then there's the public scrutiny, and, you know, and how does that impact my family, particularly in a small state like Delaware? That there may just be, there may be a moment in time now where people are just saying, you know, we're losing some people who might be willing to, you know, do those things that other people aren't willing to do because the scrutiny has gotten too much and the payoff is not there anymore.
At the same time, though, I am an eternal optimist. I think you are too, Lindsay.
Yeah.
I look at, for example, some of the younger people who are sort of coming up.
Particularly women.
And people who are very used to living sort of on social media where everything is out there. I look especially like at these students at Parkland who seem completely unaffected by, I'm sure they are affected emotionally, but they seem unaffected by really awful, horrendous things that are said about them and conspiracy theories and things. And they're still putting themselves out there and they're still sort of confident and they have a really brave public face. I wonder if for a younger generation that might be sort of used to that sort of presentation
scrutiny
of public self and scrutiny constantly, that there is going to be a new wave of publicly minded individuals running for office.
I had kind of the same take, but thinking about the other end of the generational spectrum is that, you know, baby boomers are our largest generation for the past several decades who have been ruling the country for the most part, are now smaller than millennials. Millennials have a larger vote than them, and then we have this new generation, whatever that's going to be called. Z, is that it? Generation Z? I don't know if we have a name for it yet.
The nano generation?
Something.
I just made that up.
Oh, that's good.
You like that?
Of course, well, anyway. So I'm seeing, you know, a lot of it's probably the effect of baby boomers retiring and wanting to get out of the game. I mean, we're seeing that in industries across the U.S. So some of it may be a political moment for sure, but I think it's also sort of an artifact of aging and retiring.
And this is good that we have optimists here with these cynical journalists who is just like, this is all terrible. It's not going to work out at all. Forget it.
Well, you know what? I think part of it is teaching college students.
I was just going to say that.
Yeah. It's really rewarding to see how interested and excited they are and how they really want to take part in this process, and that's part of it. And I think we have to be optimists in our classrooms.
True.
Otherwise,
what's the point?
Right.
I always joke. My husband occupies a very different social space than I do. He is a prosecutor in Camden, New Jersey, and so I spend my days with 18-year-olds who are like, "Dr. Young, can you help me get contacts so I can go build houses in the Dominican Republic for the summer?" And so I have to always remind him about like how there is this sort of just this source of positivity in this generation.
Yeah.
Just to wrap up, put a little bow on this topic, should Democrats feel better now about retaking the House the way things are going, and particularly when, you know, the Speaker, the Republican Speaker, is deciding not to run?
You know, I think Dana said before this, she's not in the speculation game. I'm kind of in that same camp. You know, things can change so dramatically. I think this is one of the things that you know, for a long time, political scientists argued that campaigns don't really matter, that you know, you can look at the economy, you can look at sort of these basic demographics and who's voting, and you can predict what's going to happen. I think that, you know, we can absolutely argue that, you know, as we become more enmeshed in a media politics era, campaigns do matter and things can change dramatically. I mean, this is April. You know, do you even remember what happened last week? I mean, it's things are happening so dramatically and so quickly, I think it's hard to prognosticate out to November.
Fair enough. We've also seen a lot of coverage about Stormy Daniels, the adult film star, and the alleged sexual encounter she had with President Trump, and perhaps attempts to cover it up by Trump or those around him. We've also seen some backlash recently on this story. Coverage of this story maybe taking the media in a direction of chasing the sensational and taking its eye off more important stories. Is that a fair critique of the media? Are they just chasing clicks and ratings with this story, or is there reason for them to be delving into this story?
You know, I think this is really interesting because I teach in my class about PAC journalism and the feeding frenzy. These are concepts of sort of what journalists do when they the feeding frenzy in particular, sort of surrounding a candidate and kind of delving into an issue just to kind of make it almost seem like it's investigative, but it's really just exploitative. The example that I use in my class is Jimmy Carter in 1976, I believe it was, in Playboy magazine said that he had often lusted after other women in his mind or something like this, and people just jumped on it. But I think what's different with this is this involves a payout. You know, this involves some legal issues that are not just a scandal about an adult film star actress. It's bigger than that.
Yeah, in my view, the fact that she is an adult film star is really should be a footnote in the story. Like, that's not, I mean, of course, that's not the footnote.
That's the hook.
That's the hook. But the story itself is important. It was interesting watching the 60 Minutes interview with Anderson Cooper. I was torn about it because I felt like he did a good job in the latter half of that interview when he's talking to the lawyer and he's basically trying to understand how this could be a violation of campaign finance laws, depending upon how that $130,000 came to be, where it came from, how it got to Stormy Daniels. That is important stuff. But the lead of that interview, the actual interview, the sit down with Stormy and the sort of lurid details of this whatever it was, night, afternoon, between her and Donald Trump, you know, that got me scratching my head about, do these details actually matter? Because the answer is they don't. I think people want to hear about them because they're really, you know, they're filthy. But there is an important story here. Whether or not the journalist deals with those important aspects of the story is still a question.
And I agree with you there. And can journalists just make a pact? We don't need to say she's a porn star anymore. We don't need to say she's an adult film actress. We all know. I have to turn the radio off about 5 times a day in my car with my child. And, you know, we don't need to keep saying it over and over again.
Yeah,
that's my plea.
It is, and again, you know, cynical journalist guy, again, it's like this is, I agree wholeheartedly. A lot of times this is what happens is that you lead with that because that's, mm-hmm. if someone's driving their car, that's going to get them to listen. If I say that one more time, opposed to.
They apparently didn't focus group test Lindsay, who shuts off her radio when they say porn star.
The funny thing about it is, but there are plenty of parents who are, myself included, who run into that situation.
Absolutely.
And I think that is something that media people tend to discount sometimes. I do want to talk about Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg testifying on Capitol Hill about handling of data on Facebook. I'm just going to kind of throw out there, what should we take away from that whole show that we saw on Capitol Hill with the founder and CEO of Facebook?
So I've got two big takeaways, two huge takeaways. And one of the takeaways is about Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook, and the other takeaway is about our lawmakers.
Mm-hmm.
So the first one, when Zuckerberg acknowledged, and he said it explicitly, Facebook is responsible for the content shared on its platform. That is huge, and that is a fundamental 180 from where the platform has been for the last 10 years, where they've said, we are just a distribution platform. We are the place where user-generated content is shared. We are not responsible for that content. So for him to say we need a broader view of our responsibility is huge. For him to literally say, yes, we are responsible for the content shared on our platform, that is going to open the door to a different gatekeeping role that he and his employees will play, possible different fact-checking roles, and possibly different mechanisms for regulation, possibly. So that's the A of that. The B of that is about our lawmakers. And I'm here to tell you that there's no way that Facebook is ever going to be adequately regulated until someone goes in and educates our lawmakers about the internal logic and the business model of these technologies, which they fundamentally do not understand.
Absolutely. Yeah, this was something I talked to my students about as well in terms of their reactions. And you know, it's kind of the running joke has been that the Senate hearings were kind of more like a 5-hour-long IT help call. whereas... in the Congress, they actually got tough. They over the House, they were asking some really tough questions. And my students, maybe again because they're young and optimistic, but they brought it back to age. They're like, the senators are just too old. Even their staffers are too old. They're not asking the right questions.
Some of the young ones also did not have any idea, though.
Good point.
How things work.
Good point. But yes, I think that was my kind of takeaway was, you know, and that might be part of why some of these folks are leaving. They might say, you know what, I just don't understand the world that we're in anymore.
I just don't know how to post something on
these
Facebook.
These interwebs are confusing to me.
I have to quit Congress. What I thought was really hilarious and depressing was the number of times that Congress people and senators would have a big piece of corkboard behind them, and it would show, like, some post or some meme, and they would say, Mr. Zuckerberg, are you familiar with this post? And he would look at them and blink, and say, no, I am not actually familiar with that specific piece of content, no. And they'd say, but it's on Facebook, why are you not familiar with it? And I'm realizing these people literally do not understand the scope of this operation, nor do they understand the role of Facebook vis-a-vis everything on its platform.
Well, I have one other takeaway from this as well.
Sure.
Because I spend a lot of time talking about media bias, and this has been something I've been fascinated by for the longest time in terms of claims of media bias. And there's tons of research that shows that across the board, there's no consistent liberal media bias. There's no conspiracy happening where you know, people are trying to be brainwashed or brainwash people. What I saw in the congressional hearing was the same arguments being put out in terms of Facebook. How many liberal people work at your company? He says, "Well, we don't really measure their political ideology when they come
because
in
because that would be illegal."
And you know, well, I don't know if you guys saw all the references to Diamond and Silk.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
So Diamond and Silk, these two conservative African American women who are big Trump supporters, you know, this became sort of the rallying cry for you're censoring conservative content.
Right. Yeah. Which was Ted Cruz spent his entire three or four minutes just asking about systematic bias against conservatives on Facebook.
And that's not what this is about.
This is not what this is about.
They should be asking about Russia. They should be asking about, you know, there's just so much more. And for me, that claim, that argument, that concern about bias, it really, what you need, when I talk to people about media bias, what I say is, look at yourself, you know, look at the kind of content you are consuming and, you know, see if you're actually the one that's, you're the one that's biased.
It's your fault. Let's victim blame. See, you're the one that's biased.
See, I'm confused because I thought this was all about Chris Coons' spoof page, the page that came up, and he had to get his staff to you know, call Facebook and find someone who could take it down for him. But actually, his point, though, aside again from the cynical journalist side, the first thing I thought was, like, is his staff that clever to create their own spoof page to give him something to talk about?
That is a conspiracy theory. You just started a conspiracy theory.
I know, and it's like, it's terrible. It's terrible that my mind goes there. But the point that he did bring up, though, I thought was an interesting one, which is, like, you know, he had a staff to go and take care of this and figure it out. How does, like, the average person deal with it when it comes up? And those are, like, the kind of littler issues that are a pretty big deal.
Well, and this is what I've been saying. You know, I teach about technology and politics. I do research in this area. I've been saying, and a lot of my colleagues across the globe have been saying, we can't let the technology develop without considering moral, ethical, and social issues. You know, like, remember when it was a big deal, like, whoa, what if someone dies? What happens to their Facebook page? Or, I mean, when they introduced Facebook Live, how no one sitting around that table could anticipate that people would use that to record sexual assault, suicide, homicide. You know, we need to have social scientists.
Move fast and break things, Lindsay.
No, I won't do it.
No, I'm saying that's what they... No, don't yell at me. Wait, can I just say one last thing on this topic?
Yes.
What I think is really fascinating about this is when you listen to the questioning of the Republicans and Democrats, it was such a wonderful example of the two different political ideologies in terms of how they oriented the world, because you had a lot of Democratic lawmakers saying, why aren't you doing more to regulate this speech and that speech, and why aren't you taking these things down, and these things are harmful? Then you have Republicans saying, why are you taking these things down? Why aren't you letting me say this and say that?
Huh.
So this really wild dichotomy between the Republicans who want the freedom to do things, and Democrats who are saying, I want freedom from
this
harmful speech.
That is really, really interesting. I do want to wrap up on one other local point. I know neither of you are big on the procrastination game, but I do have to at least mention that former Governor Jack Markell has started to like resurface a little bit more recently. You know, after he left office, the big thing was he rode his bike across the country. Yeah. Now he's kind of back into the policy game, had a Washington Post op-ed weighing in on Trump immigration policy, joined a panel of former governors at Harvard in a forum on the opioid crisis. I'm not going to ask you to speculate specifically on Governor Markell's future, but having said all that, and knowing that he didn't say anything that was particularly headline worthy, if this is just kind of guy X or gal X, does this feel like someone who's trying to get themselves back into a position to do something at some point?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you insert yourself in the headlines in that way, you are wanting to still play the game, still be in, still be visible. You know, I say to Governor Markell, if he wants to keep that visibility, he can come on down to National Agenda this fall. We've had former governors appear on our stage, and
former vice presidents,
Mr. Joe Biden. So and current sitting governors and John Kasich. So hey, you're welcome. Come on down.
There you go. Maybe I should put a plug in. We can use some political analysts for election night if he's got nothing better to do on election night.
There you
go. Come to our studio and hang out and just kind of riff on what he sees going on. All right, we finish up each podcast with giving you an opportunity to do what we were joking about before we started, is a quick take, a hot take, a quickly hot take, a hotly quick take, something that you think is interesting, lighthearted. I was going to say a prediction, but you don't want to do predictions, so maybe something that's just not getting the attention it deserves. Dana, we'll start with you.
Well, my hot, quick hot take was really about Mark Zuckerberg, which you asked me point blank, so that's good. I know, darn it to heck. But I do have another one, if you're looking for another one.
Sure, absolutely.
And that is that I think that...
You always got backups.
I always have backups, because this is always moving. You see this brain?
Mind.
Always moving.
I get it.
I think that... With regards to the book by Comey, this is a really interesting opportunity, I think, for people to consider, like what you were talking about with regards to what you were talking about, Lindsay, about people's perception of media bias. You know, there was a time, people might not remember this, there was a time when Democrats thought that Comey was the enemy and that Comey had it out for Hillary and that Comey was somehow in bed with Trump. And now here we are, and Comey has a book that is telling his side of the story. And I think that we all need to take down our partisan filters a bit and just engage in the consumption of information with the possibility that the people who are speaking might actually have something to say.
Very good. Lindsay?
Well, I did have something to say about what's happening in Syria, but then you said something lighthearted.
Well, I mean, so. It doesn't have to be lighthearted. I'm
right.
Just,
well, I think...
I'm opening the door to that.
Yeah. Well, I think actually, I mean, to keep it lighthearted, I think what I've seen, if I'm going to give a quick hot quick take, is that... we've seen podcasts, news magazines, news media in general, I think, becoming more creative in the era of Trump. It seems like we're seeing new kinds of media, new kinds of satire, new kinds of political commentary. So one guy that I've been really interested in lately and following is he's on YouTube, and he actually is traveling the country right now. His name's Randy Rainbow.
Love Randy Rainbow.
And he actually sort of inserts satire and musical theater and Trump criticism kind of all in one, and it's just fascinating to me. And then the other thing I was going to point out was the recent revelation of the Time magazine cover. They actually have this kind of interactive cover, and it shows a Donald Trump sitting at his desk in the Oval Office, says nothing to see here, and we see slowly this ocean rising and wind blowing around his desk, and it just says stormy.
Thanks again to UD Center for Political Communication Associate Director and National Agenda Series Director Dr. Lindsay Hoffman and UD Associate Professor of Communication Dr. Danny Young for their time on the Midterm Matters podcast, produced by the University of Delaware Center for Political Communication and Delaware Public Media. For more on the UD Center for Political Communication's Midterm Matters National Agenda Series coming this fall, visit cpc.udel.edu. And that's a wrap on this week's edition of The Green. The stories, interviews, and podcasts you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to everyone who helped make today's show possible, UD professors Dr. Danny Young and Dr. Lindsay Hoffman, for joining us on the Midterm Matters podcast, Delaware Public Media's Katie Pikus and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thank you for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.